You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Robert Bound. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as Tehran's symbolic bazaar shuts up shop for day two in protest at Iran's currency meltdown, we ask where now for Iran's economy. And Brazil's local elections approaching this weekend, we see which candidates are most likely to win, from Salvador to Porto Alegre.
And I have to say, Porto Alegre has a tradition to vote for the left. They're the first capital to vote for the left ever in Brazil. I think they elected their Workers' Party candidate in 88.
Author of upcoming book Governing the World, The History of an Idea, Mark Mazower joins us to explain the history of internationalism.
Nobody really talks about internationalism today, but it was the word that was used to convey that perhaps if you got people to cooperate with one another across state borders, the world would be a better place.
And as Jack Kerouac's original On the Road scroll is unveiled, we speak to one of the beat writer's pals, collaborators, and jazz musician David Amran. All that, plus we play some great music too, all to come in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. But first, at 6:01 London time, it's time for the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
The dangers of cyberspace crime featured highly today at a two-day international cyberspace conference in the Hungarian capital Budapest. The British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, said it had never been easier to become a cyber criminal.
Cyberspace is emerging as a new dimension in conflicts of the future. Many nations simply do not yet have the defences or the resources to counter state-sponsored cyber attack. If we don't find ways of agreeing principles to moderate such behaviour and to deal with its consequences, then some countries could find themselves vulnerable to a wholly new strategic threat, effectively held to ransom by hostile states.
Syria has apologised for the mortar strike which killed 5 civilians in southeast Turkey, saying it was an accident. As the Turkish Labour Minister Faruk Çelik visited the wounded, many Turks welcomed their army's swift reprisal artillery strike, while journalist Murat Agun said the response sent a clear message to Damascus.
Turkey has no intention to get into war with Syria tomorrow morning. But on the other hand, this message means Turkey, Turkish government, has no any more tolerance the death of its citizens in the Turkish territories. If there is an attack, if there is an attack from the Syrian side, 100% there will be an answer to Syria.
A Dutch campaign group attempting to dock its so-called abortion ship in a Moroccan port has been denied entry. Women on Waves, which offers abortion services to women on board its specially equipped boat, said Moroccan warships were blocking the entrance to Smir Harbour to prevent the vessel from docking. Well, the group's founder, Rebecca Gompertz, said they visit countries where abortion is illegal.
Every 5 minutes, somewhere in the world, a woman is dying because she has been denied the access to safe and legal abortion. We consider this an enormous medical problem. It's one of the biggest medical problems related to pregnancy for women. We consider that a gross violation of women's human rights, and we are unwilling to stand by and do nothing about it.
Serbia, which has banned Belgrade Pride, a march by gay activists planned for Saturday, has been told it must better protect human rights if it wants to join the European Union. The EU, United Nations and Amnesty International were among those denouncing the ban. The march was also banned last year. The morning after the first presidential debate between Republican nominee Mitt Romney and President Barack Obama, many voters said Romney performed better than expected. Melanie Sloan from Washington, D.C. and John Greenbowl from Virginia both watched the debate.
I did watch the debate and I thought there was no clear winner. I thought Mr. Romney performed better than expected. And I thought it was a very substantive debate with lots of details about the economics that I think should help viewers and voters decide what they want to do at the polls in November.
I thought Romney won. I thought he was more articulate. I thought he was more to the point. I thought that he threw Obama off his messaging by denying, for instance, the $5 trillion tax cut. It was almost like, that's just absolutely wrong. I never said that. And it kind of left Obama, I thought, with not a good comeback to that.
And finally, Canadian police have stopped the sweetest crime of the year, seizing thousands of gallons of maple syrup from an exporter on suspicions it was part of a cache of syrup that went missing from a Quebec warehouse in late August. Police have today removed about 1,000 barrels or 600,000 pounds of maple syrup from a storage facility in Kedgewick. That's in the neighbouring province of New Brunswick. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, John. It's an 18.05 here, which means you are tuned in to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres. Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Това е Монако, 24.
From London.
In London.
London, Кара.
De Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
It is Monocle 24. I'm Robert Bound. This is Midori House. Off to Iran we go. Seen as a barometer of the Iranian economy, the famous Tehran Bazaar has ceased trading for a second day in a row after protests at the state of the Iranian economy and the plummeting value of its rial currency on Wednesday were dispersed by riot police at the bazaar. Meanwhile, currency shops in Tehran remain shuttered as the rial is no longer traded for foreign money. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has blamed the enemies of Iran for economic sanctions imposed to curb their Iranian nuclear program, yet his critics say the economy should not be held to ransom for his personal beliefs. Well, Mahred Vezinejan, journalist and Iranian commentator, joins us on the line now to explain just what might be at stake. Mahred, thank you for joining us on Midori House.
My pleasure.
Now, first of all, let's get the situation on the ground sorted out. Yesterday, there, as we said in the introduction there were some violent clashes. Is it a little calmer today? Maybe too calm?
Yes, it is. To some extent, it's because, in Iran, like many other Muslim countries, the weekend is on Thursday and Friday, not Saturday and Sunday. So Thursdays and Fridays are calmer and much so in the bazaar. So that might be a reason. Nothing has changed really on the ground in terms of the economical problems or the dissatisfaction of the people in the bazaar. So I think it's mostly because it's calmer on the weekend in Iran.
And I think we all have an image in our head of the Tehran Bazaar, and we feel it is a teeming place. It is a sort of stereotypically busy place. Is its importance sort of merely symbolic as something, as an idea in our sort of mind's eye, or is this a proper, serious, practical problem?
It is a serious problem because the bazaar traditionally, after the revolution for the Islamic Republic, is always the supporter of the clergy, and they have very close ties, the bazaar and the clergy. So when trouble begins in the bazaar, it shows that something serious is going on, and it really is a different matter from what we had, for example, in 2009, and people protesting over their votes and an election that people thought that was rigged. That was quite a different story. Many of the people, I suspect, that were on the streets and around the bazaar, on the streets around the bazaar during yesterday, not today that much, probably didn't participate in what was happening in 2009. And these are people who would traditionally be, if not supporters of the Islamic Republic, but people with some sort of sympathy. So now these people coming out and protesting, I think it's much more significant.
And with an idea again to the practicality and the usefulness and the importance of the bazaar as a focal point symbolically, but as a place to simply do your shopping and do business, are people going without because it's closed?
In the recent years, the symbolic significance of the bazaar is much more important now. I mean, because in the recent years we have a lot of these like Western modern shopping malls all around the capital, that many people actually go to these stores to buy what they need, or supermarkets that we have. Previously, we didn't have these some sort of stores in Tehran, so the bazaar was much more significant. Now, in terms of just day-to-day shopping of the people, it isn't that significant. Where it is important is about the wholesale, And the retailers, they don't go to shopping malls, obviously. They go to the bazaar to get their wholesale and then take it to the retail. Mm-hmm. Now they are faced with the problem because the bazaar is closed and those few shops that are open are not willing to sell because many of the commodities are imported. And because of the, you know, because of the huge rise in the dollar price and because of the string, I mean, it goes up and down, the uncertainty that's in the market, they don't know really how much they should sell their products. That's why that their retailers have the problem when they go to the bazaar. They cannot buy there from the wholesaler, basically.
And how much do you think this is to do with the currency devaluation, to do with economic sanctions being put on Iran?
It's almost certainly because of the devaluation of rial. The interesting point is, I mean, that what you said in your introduction about Ahmadinejad saying this is due to the sanctions, and we can see now the rift between President Ahmadinejad and the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei on this regard, because for the first time there is a protest in Tehran going on, and actually the official news outlets are reporting it, saying that there are widespread protests and people are unhappy about the state of the economy. This is because I think they are using Ahmadinejad and the government as a scapegoat, wanting to say that the one to blame is the government because they've mismanaged the economy. And on the other side, you see Ahmadinejad coming for the first time saying that it is not just about the economy and the role of the government. It's mostly because of the sanctions and there's not much we can do. The reason he says that is because everyone knows that the foreign policy and the nuclear issue in the end goes down to the supreme leader, and it's not the government, it's not Ahmadinejad or foreign secretary who has any say on that. So when the president comes and says this is due to the sanctions, he's basically referring to the nuclear issue and the foreign policy, which is down to the supreme leader. So it shows the rift, basically, that I think, although this is a popular protest and people are unhappy, but the establishment, the supreme leader, and many of the conservatives would try to blame the government for this and not to be blamed themselves, basically.
That was interesting. That's going to be my next question about this. It's rare. It must be a rare thing for Ahmadinejad to have to explain himself in front of his people, and for the state-run media not to presumably support him in everything he does. For this thing to be on the TV and on the radio at all in Iran is a rarity.
Yes, it is. Basically, he talks to the people very often, but the tone he had a couple of days ago, it was very different to what we have seen of him. I mean, he was very critical of other parts of the establishment of the Islamic Republic. He was very, very vocal and critical about the legislative and the judiciary. And he was trying to say that there are different hands, not just foreign, but inside Iran, that are aggravating the situation. And the problem is not just down to the government. Whereas, as I said, on the other side, the Supreme Leader and others try to basically say, no, this is not the problem of the establishment and the system as a whole. This is the problem of the government. And we know that maybe 8 months is left from Ahmadinejad's presidency. So what they're looking after, the Supreme Leader and the conservatives, is maybe they can get rid of Ahmadinejad in a few months' time and they don't face much more trouble. But because this is economy and this is not just political stuff like 2009, every single people feels it, and that's the reason that we have the protests in the bazaar, which is, as I said, traditionally very conservative. And I do think really that it would be very difficult if it takes any more widespread than this, it would be very difficult to control it like what happened in 2009.
So you see this potentially as a Tehran watcher, but based in London, as a fact that maybe the sanctions are doing their job, but also that the everyday man on the street is suffering for it, and therefore Ahmadinejad will maybe in 6 months' time.
Yes, definitely the people who are suffering. The ones suffering most are ordinary people because of the sanctions. But ultimately, I think the ordinary people, although they're very unhappy about what's happening to their country, in terms of what the West, Britain, or the United States, or the European Union are doing in terms of sanctions, they're unhappy. But ultimately, I think they blame their own government and their own system because of that. And it would be, I think, in the coming months, it would be very difficult for the Islamic Republic to continue the line that it is doing regarding the nuclear issue. I'm not saying that they will change it, but it would get increasingly difficult. And maybe that's the reason that Secretary Clinton came out and said that as soon as the Iranian regime basically changes its behavior, the sanctions will be lifted. I think she has sensed that the sentiment in Tehran, they will put a lot of pressure on the government, because the people who hear it would say, look, the other side is willing to compromise and alleviate the situation if you do some positive stuff and you omit them. So I think although it's a matter of national pride and people do support the nuclear issue, but as things are getting tougher and tougher, I think it would get increasingly difficult for the government to justify the nuclear program.
Well, Mehrad, thank you very much for joining us. That was Mehrad Fezinjan, a journalist and Iranian commentator. And you are listening to Midori House. I'm Robert Bound. We'll be back after this for a look at what to expect in Brazil's upcoming elections.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
Metaphorical passports at the ready, Monocle Films travels across continents and cultures for the second of our special reports from this year's Venice Architecture Biennale.
The 30 permanent national pavilions here are themselves a showcase of architectural imagination. Inside, each country has a platform to show, promote, and discuss whatever they choose. As with any event that pits nations side by side, just like Eurovision or the Olympics, there's a healthy dose of intrigue and sporting rivalry.
Going for gold at the Venice Architecture Biennale on Monocle.com.
And you are back with Midori House, where the time is 18:17 here in London. Now, each day this week, we're taking a moment to look at the upcoming Brazilian local elections on Sunday. Today, we'll do a roundup of six other important Brazilian capitals that are choosing its mayors, from Salvador to Porto Alegre. Our resident Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, caught up with Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. They also managed to include a little music too, Brazil's tropical electro queen, no less.
Fernando, so far we've talked about Sao Paulo, we've talked about Rio, we've talked about Belo Horizonte. Today, we're going to cover six elections, all in one little slot.
Oh, God.
Let's go. Where are we starting?
Shall we start with Curitiba?
Yes.
So, again, another TV host leading the polls, not only Sao Paulo, and is Ratinho Jr. I mean, probably you don't know, guys, but Ratinho is like a Brazilian Jerry Springer. He's quite trashy, I have to say. And, well, not very good news for Curitiba, but we can move on to Porto Alegre, maybe?
Okay, let's do that.
And I have to say, Porto Alegre has a tradition to vote for the left. They're the first capital to vote for the left ever in Brazil. I think they elected a Workers' Party candidate in 88. And again, the first two candidates, they are from the left. José Fortunati probably will be re-elected with 47% of the vote. And Manuela Dávila from the Communist Party, she's in second with 24%. She could do better, but she didn't run a very good campaign. It was a bit lackluster. So,
and our third city.
Third city. Shall we go to Recife?
Let's.
And again, Socialist Geraldo Júlio is ahead with 42% of the vote, followed by Social Democrat Daniel Coelho with 22%. And more bad news for the Workers' Party. Humberto Costa, which was on the lead like a month ago because of the Mensalão, dropped to third place, 17%.
The corruption scandals.
Exactly.
But some good news for the Workers' Party in our next city, Salvador.
Exactly, where they have a very strong tradition there. And Nelson Pellegrino is leading with 34%. And you're asking me about this yesterday, Steve. We have ACM Neto, he's a conservative. And
okay.
He's second, he's a proper conservative.
So he's not afraid of calling himself conservative.
He's not afraid, probably one of the few, actually. And he's 31% of the vote.
Okay, and now we've got two more left. Let's do Fortaleza.
Yeah, Fortaleza, again, Workers' Party is doing quite well, 24%. But, you know, there's so many, it's a very tight dispute. We have Socialist Roberto Claudio with 19%, Conservative Moroni Torgan with 18%, and Heitor Ferrer from PDT with 13%. So, no, it's...
So you've got four candidates there, really, and still at this stage,
yeah.
No idea who's going to win. Okay, and our final city for today.
The final city is where we're going to show. I'm going to put a song from this city. It's from Belém in Pará, where they might have the first far-left mayor in Brazil.
Okay.
From his name is Edmilson Rodrigues, and he's on the lead with 25%. And if I can introduce the song,
you certainly can.
Let's put a song of the Brazilian electropop queen Gabi Amarantos. Ela tá beba doida.
And that was Brazil's Gabi Amarantos. And that song's called She's Drunk, She's Crazy. I'm not entirely sure whether you'd have got that from the way that the song sounded, possibly. And before that, sounding a little bit different, you heard Fernando Augusto Pacheco talking to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about the art of political speaking. It's Midori House, it's 1824 here in London. The first political debate of the US presidential race is over. The media hailed Republican Mitt Romney the victor, while Democrat supporters questioned Obama's reluctance to use the obvious attack lines gifted him by the opposition. Are there tactics at play here too subtle for us to notice, or was Obama's performance underwhelming for the very fact he was underprepared? Meanwhile, Ed Miliband, the leader of the opposition here in the UK, and not considered the most obvious orator, wowed both sides of the political circus with a speech that lasted 75 minutes, performed with no notes, in front of thousands. So what is it that lies behind a convincing political speech? Where in the balance between detailed hectoring and broad brushstrokes resides the speech fit for the day in question? Well, speechwriter for former British politician Lord Ashdown and author of Lend Me Your Ears, All You Need to Know About Public Speaking, is Matt Atkinson, and he's here to help us decipher the hallowed art of political speeches. Max, thanks for joining us on Midori House. That was quite a long introduction, wasn't it? I'm finished now. I'm just going to sit here and let you talk. I expect you can do it as well. That's the art of it.
Well, I don't know who can does, who can't teaches.
Now, what I wanted to know, really, in the age of television, have these speeches simply got longer? I mean, when people did stump speeches 100 years ago or spoke to people, was it in shorter bursts as they travel around the country?
Quite the opposite. I mean, if anything, they've got shorter. But the things that have changed is that nobody quite knows how the thing works across television screens. So it may well be that although everyone's saying, oh dear, Obama didn't do too well last night, it may well be that actually he didn't do at all badly, because it's extremely difficult to measure what the impact is when you're dealing with audiences of millions who are watching television.
And obviously, for politicians in the last 20 years, it's not television hasn't just been the add-on thing to the stuff you do in Parliament, especially when you're electioneering. TV presumably is the be-all and end-all. You have to train yourself to be a TV politician first and a politician second, presumably.
Well, to some extent, that is certainly true. But the thing is that a good speaker is a good speaker. So, that, for example, in British politics in recent years, by far the best speakers have been Tony Blair, Margaret Thatcher, and, surprise, surprise, David Cameron. And these people are good, technically very good. And what I mean by that is that they use the rhetorical techniques that have been used for the last 2,000 years with great effect. And it's also true of Obama. He's absolutely brilliant when he's making a speech. It may be that he's not quite so good when he's engaged in a so-called debate. But these debates, as we saw a couple of years ago in Britain, they're fairly sort of phony events, and nobody quite knows how to play them.
And you say they're phony events. Is this because the questions are arranged in advance, and there is almost the fact that you can prepare a speech for each individual answer?
I mean, to some extent. I mean, I remember with the TV debates here, there was something like, I don't know, was it 63 rules? There was a huge number of rules that the people were supposed to follow. And you thought, well, how could anybody possibly follow all these rules? And the answer is that they really couldn't. And there's a limit to how far they can constrain things. So, for example, it's conventional in these debates that the audiences mustn't applaud. But actually, in American debates, quite often the audiences do applaud. And the reason they applaud is that the speaker uses rhetorical techniques that trigger applause. And if you wanted to stop them applauding, you'd actually have to make them wear handcuffs or stop the speakers using the most powerful rhetorical techniques known to man.
And this presumably one of the secrets of presumably winning one of these debates or going across well on a TV discussion program is interacting with the audience, is currying a bit of favour, right?
Well, very much so. And of course, the interesting thing about if you have a look at the speech by Miliband yesterday, the people who are really going berserk about it and saying it's wonderful are the media. But my question is, what do the public think about it? Because, of course, the public don't watch these speeches. You know, they're not sitting there in front of the BBC Parliament Channel watching the whole 75-minute speech or however long it lasts for. All they get to see are a few clips on television news programmes singled out from on a very vague basis by media editors who somehow think they know what they should show a wider audience.
And if it's one of the golden rules to sort of be, I guess you need to think about the words you say and get them in the right order, and you need to have some sort of natural rhythm, or taught rhythm, Max, as I'm sure you could teach us. But do you have to be quite sparing with the content? Do you have to keep hammering home the same key points you want to make rather than telling a very sort of detailed and complicated sort of story?
Absolutely. I mean, when people say to me, what's the biggest problem that I've come across since I started working in this area, I say, without any question, it's seeing speakers trying to get far too much information across than is actually possible with the spoken word. I mean, you know about the spoken word because that's what you do. You can't get much across. And one of Gordon Brown's problems was that whenever he was making a speech, it was almost as though he saw it as a chance to give a university lecture. And so his speeches were very information-heavy, and audiences were, to say the least, not very inspired by them.
All right, Max. Well, on that note, and we'll have to get you back in and talk for longer next time, Max Atkinson, political speechwriter and expert, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. It's 18:30. We're going to have the news headlines next. And you're back with Midori House. In the next half hour of the show, we hear how the price of an ice cream in Argentina has tripled, explore the new exhibition of Jack Kerouac's infamous On the Road scroll, and hear from author Mark Mazzauer on his new book, Governing the World. But first, at half past the hour with the news headlines, Jonathan Wheatley.
Thank you very much. The dangers of cyberspace crime featured highly today at a two-day international cyberspace conference in the Hungarian capital, Budapest. The British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, said it had never been easier to become a cyber criminal. Syria has apologised for the mortar strike which killed five civilians in southeast Turkey, saying it was an accident. As the Turkish Labour Minister Faruk Çelik visited the wounded, many Turks welcomed their army's swift reprisal artillery strike. A Dutch campaign group attempting to dock its so-called abortion ship in a Moroccan port has been denied entry. Women on Waves, which offers abortion services to women on board its specially equipped boat, said Moroccan warships were blocking the entrance to Smir harbour to prevent the vessel from docking. Serbia, which has banned Belgrade Pride, a march by gay activists planned for Saturday, has been told it must better protect human rights if it wants to join the European Union. The EU, United Nations and Amnesty International were among those denouncing the ban. And the morning after the first presidential debate between Republican nominee Mitt Romney and President Barack Obama, many voters said Romney performed better than expected. Those are the stories for the moment.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and you're back with Midori House. It's 18:31, and we're coming to you live from Studio One in London. The story of global cooperation between nations and peoples is a tale of dreamers goading us to find common cause in remedying humanity's worst problems. But international institutions have also provided a tool for the powers that be to advance their own interests and stamp their imprint on the world. Mark Mazzauer's Governing the World tells the story of that inevitable and irresolvable tension, the unstable alchemy between ideas and power. I spoke to the author, Mark, a little earlier and began by asking him whether the title, Governing the World, the History of the Idea, hints to a sense of historical internationalism.
Well, yes, it is, I suppose, except that nobody really talks about internationalism today or has much of an idea what it means anymore, I think. But it was the word that was used through the 19th century and well into the 20th to convey the sense that perhaps if you got people to cooperate with one another across state borders in one way or another, the world would be a better place. The one way or another was important because there were, in fact, many, many different conceptions about how to do this, and quite a number of them turned out to be deeply influential through the 20th century and to have shaped the world we're in now.
And the book starts in the sort of post-Napoleonic era, 1815, when Europe was sort of racked by war, and it seemed that there needed to be some sort of structure, at least cooperation, loosely or sort of solidly built, that would stop this from happening again. Obviously, these thoughts have sort of echoed through, down through history. Is the idea of internationalism and then the Council of Europe, the Concert of Europe, and the different bodies, were they there really, and this idea of internationalism, to sort of put a check on the naked ambition of nation states and their rulers?
Well, they were in the first incarnation, they were there to put a check on the naked ambition of any future Napoleon. Mm-hmm. And that was why his victors decided to band together. And in a sense, they invent the idea that there might be some systematic way of governing, if not the world, then Europe. That's where it starts. But really, the energy comes in with all those people who just detested Metternich and detested Castlereagh and thought they were all conservatives and just upholding the divine right of kings and bringing emperors back onto their thrones, people like Shelley and Byron and Mazzini and Karl Marx. And it was those kinds of people who, in the 1830s and 40s and 50s, start pushing very hard for a much more radical interpretation of internationalism, and they're not so worried about any return of a Napoleon. In fact, many of them are not that bothered when another Napoleon comes back in France. They're bothered about this kind of encrusted reaction that's returned to Europe after Napoleon's defeat, and they want to sweep that away. And they, if you're Karl Marx, they want to bring in a world in which workers can band together, and if you're a nationalist, a world in which nations can band together. What intrigued me was seeing the 19th century in terms of these radical visions, competing radical visions, offered you perhaps a new light on many of the fundamental international disputes of the 20th century.
And I wanted to talk to that, to bring up the sort of the Concert of Europe, which was the sort of prime mover of these internationalist organisations, the United Nations, NATO, the European Union. These things prospered during the war and after the Second World War. Is it a lack of ideology, perhaps, now that sees them being weakened?
Yes, I think so. I mean, to write a history of the Council of Europe or the United Nations, and some people have done it, is an incredibly boring thing. I mean, nobody wants to read the history of bureaucracies, and certainly I didn't want to write the history of bureaucracies. But I think when they worked was when ideas breathed life into them and when people believed passionately in some idea and thought that this was the way to get that idea realized. So the ideas come first, I think, and belief in the ideas comes first. And I think that today we suffer from a loss of confidence in ideas of international cooperation, and these organizations suffer as a result. All that is left is the bureaucratic husk.
And it was the failure of the UN. I know in the introduction to your book you talk about the sort of failure of the UN that allowed bombs to rain down on Iraq, certainly the last time. Is this how the sort of lessons of the post-Napoleonic Europe are sort of still catching up with us?
Well, I think that's one way in which they're catching up with us. Of course, as somebody said, would it have been better if the UN had blessed the war in Iraq and the bombs that had rained down on Iraq had been UN approved? No. I'm not sure that it would have been necessarily. We would have felt something different about the UN. But what I'm saying is, I suppose one can criticize the UN, as in any organization, both for the things that it does and for the things that it doesn't do. That just means it's an ordinary kind of organization. I think the big battle that's confronting us right now is not really around anything the UN does, because I don't think the UN is really at the center of anything anymore, but it's in Europe, around the European Union. And the European Union has greater powers, I think, than any international organization has ever had that one can think of, powers willingly granted to it by its member states, but that are now creating enormous social and political turmoil. That's very fascinating historically.
And this is the idea of having to have certain amount of standards to join a certain club, isn't it, Mark, I suppose, and failing to meet those standards even when you've been allowed into the club means that not necessarily sabres rattle across the continent, but certainly economic grumbles get louder and louder.
Well, the economic measures that are taken in order to uphold those agreed standards start to have very deep political and social consequences in the countries concerned, in Spain, in Greece, in Portugal. They cause tremendous social upheaval. Of course, one must remember, has to be said about the way the IMF treated South Korea or Malaysia or Argentina, right? Europe is learning what it is like to be subjected to the rules, internationally imposed rules of some kind of agency. Now, these are agencies that these countries themselves have decided to join. Nevertheless, that doesn't stop there being tremendous political consequences and points at which people will say, well, why did we join that organization and do we want it any longer? That's happened with the IMF. You'll find that the countries in South America and East Asia that went through the debt crises of the 80s and 90s are keeping the IMF at arm's length. And the interesting question is whether that will happen to the European Union. In other words, whether member states of the European Union, their electorates will take the view that this is not what we signed up for. And either we want out, or we want some renegotiation of terms, or we want out of part of it.
All right, and that was Mark Mazower, author of Governing the World, The History of an Idea, speaking to me a little earlier on today. And you are tuned in to Midori House.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop on all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
And you are listening to Midori House with me, Robert Bounds. As the summer heat begins to fade, Argentinians will hope that the seasonally inflated prices of one of their favourite consumables, ice cream, will start to melt down to their pre-summer rates. None of the inflation ripping through the economy has anything to do with it, however. Reported by some economists as nearing 25%, a figure disputed by President Cristina Kirchner, prices for common goods are jumping by the day, yet the economy is reportedly showing steady growth. Ice cream in chain stores is reported to have tripled in price. So how are the consumers responding and what is it doing to the ice cream industry? Journalist, resident of Buenos Aires and ice cream lover, Marcia Carnamo joins us on the line now to discuss this meltdown of a problem. Marcia, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Hi.
I guess it's a while since you licked anything sticky off your fingers then in Buenos Aires.
Oh, yes. I live here and I love the Argentine ice cream. In fact, they are wonderful. And today, nowadays, the story is everywhere here in Argentina. And it is very interesting because brands like Fredo, Persico, and Volta are going to another countries like Brazil and Chile too. But the problem, as you said, is the price.
And I mean, has it really skyrocketed in line with everything else, or has ice cream been singled out as a luxury?
Oh yes, ice cream is today is like a symbol here, and is reflecting the price. In fact, comparing with 3 years ago, the price of the ice cream here in Buenos Aires has risen more than 100%. In this period of time, the official inflation was around 34%. I remember, Robert, that last year I bought the little one with 10 pesos. Now, yesterday, I went to Fredo and I bought the little one with 22 pesos. So the inflation is true.
That sounds like a sort of crazy raise of inflation. I mean, are people cutting back on things, or are just people grumbling about it? I mean, is it making a big difference to that sort of mid-afternoon craving for something sweet?
Yes, it's different. It's really different. In fact, here we use it to have ice cream during the afternoon or at night because it's a very interesting thing. Fredo, Persico, Volta, and other brands, they are not only a place where we can have an ice cream, but a coffee too. It is some coffee. coffees here, cafes, like we say here, the ice cream brands are also place to have a coffee and to have ice cream. It is a culture, it is in the culture of the country, something like that.
All right, Marcia. Well, thank you so much for shedding some light on the Argentinian ice cream meltdown. We'll have to check in with you at a later date to see if it's cheaper to get something cold in your mouth. That was Marcia Como on the line from Buenos Aires. We're going to have a song now. We're staying in Argentina. This is Miranda with Yo Te Dere. And just a taster of Miranda and Yo Te Dire. We'll be back right after this to hear about the new exhibition celebrating the Bible of the Beat Generation. It's 18:45 in London and it's Midori House, a counterculture classic that inspired the Beat Generation of poets, writers, artists and musicians searching for meaning in post-war America. Jack Kerouac's On the Road was hyped up onto 120-foot scroll in a burst of creative energy in April 1951. Determined not to let that creativity be hampered by the task of changing the typewriter paper, Kerouac taped 100 sheets of paper together to allow for the seamless and uninterrupted recollection of his journeys through America. The full scroll, in all its stream of consciousness glory, is being displayed at a new exhibition at London's British Library. David Amran, jazz musician, friend and collaborator to Kerouac, joined me a little earlier to recall some of the memories he shared with the writer. It seems to me, on my first reading of On the Road, it seemed like a book that kind of captured the great oral tradition of America, but like in novel form. Is that something that sort of comes together in your mind, the kind of improvisatory spirit of stuff together with getting it down on paper?
Oh, definitely, because being a storyteller and speaking so that when you read, you feel that the author is speaking to you is really the fundament, I believe, of everything from the King James Bible to the ancient texts in any and every language. The Iliad and the Odyssey, of course, Homer couldn't see, so he was the first great freestyler or rapper that we know about, because fortunately someone else wrote his freestyle rap down, since he could not see, and he was accompanied, apparently, by a musician who played the ancient instrument called the lira, which was a kind of a Greek laptop. So when Jack and I did the first ever jazz poetry readings in New York in 1957, we were simply doing what Homer had done, what King David had done when he would read those poems accompanied by a harp player, and carrying on an old tradition of telling stories, of making things up on the spot. Saying, I'm so happy to be here at the British Museum, and I'm so glad that I could come back to England again. So for this beautiful show of our man Jack Kerouac, I can only say amen. That type of...
I hope our listeners can hear your fingers clicking in the background there, David, because I feel like that's that we want to. I wish that we could take that beat a little bit further on. Before we do, and we might end like that, I wanted to ask you about that idea that when you were doing these poetry and jazz mashups in New York City back then, did you feel that you were doing something new, or was it only later that you realized that you were making like Homer?
No, we were just having a good time. Because Jack, when I first met him at a bring-your-own-bottle party in 1956, before On the Road had come out, he had one book, The Town and the City, which sold about 1,200 copies. It was a wonderful book, but he was totally unknown. I was writing music for Shakespeare in the Park in New York City as a budding classical composer, playing French horn with Charles Mingus, and working in the United States Post Office. So we were what you would call similar to Charles Mingus, whom I played with, who wrote a book called Beneath the Underdog. Mm-hmm. We had no place to go but up. And we had such a good time. Jack would pull out a piece of paper or read something from memory. I didn't know if it were Charles Dickens or in French if it was Victor Hugo or Celine or a poem by Gregory Corso or something that he was making up on the spot. And I would just play music for it. And we did that so often, a good friend of ours says, why don't you guys give a public jazz poetry reading? And Jack said, well, we really call it music poetry, poetry music, not jazz poetry. And the person said, well, that would be a little too obscure. Call it jazz poetry. So they made a little poster, jazz poetry reading. And we went to this little art gallery. And it was so much fun that we then did it at a place called Circle in the Square Theater. And then jazz poetry became kind of a fad, where someone who had never written a poem before would bellow and scream into the microphone as loudly as possible while the band would play I've Got Rhythm and see if they could blow the poet off the bandstand.
So it's kind of like a battle of the DJs.
Yeah,
it's kind of
precisely.
Come bang up to date.
Right. Needless to say, that lasted about 2 months, and Jack said, that's not anything I can stand. Let's just go back to doing it at friends' apartments, which we continue to do the rest of our lives. And I also wrote music for a score for a film called Pull My Daisy, which Jack narrated. And we did that and wrote a song together. And I used to back him up at different things. And I also wrote a cantata. And recently I wrote a concerto for the great James Galway. And the second movement was dedicated to Jack Kerouac and used two French-Canadian songs he used to sing to me. So we stayed in contact and did things together. But at the very beginning, our friendship was based on the fact that we both enjoyed people. We were interested in a lot of different things. We loved sports and music, the classics, and the beautiful way that everyday people spoke and played music and created things.
And I wanted to ask you about that. I wanted to get a sense of the spirit, of the attitude of those years in the late 1940s in New York City, when after Jack had written the book, or at least he's done his research trips and he'd done that map that On the Road became, I guess. That seemed to me, when I saw it on the television doing some research for this interview, David, a little bit like a musical score. I guess that was something that you as a musician half used and half didn't. Half of the music you wrote was written down and half of it was improvised, I guess.
Well, the things I did with Jack, except for a cantata that I wrote where I set his music for a chorus and symphony, his words, and some of the music I did for the film Pull My Daisy, where I used a chamber music orchestra and a jazz ensemble where everything was written out, was always improvised. And one of the nice things is that in some of the things I did, you can't tell which was improvised and which was composed. Because like Jack, I always wanted it to appear to be natural, to be spontaneous, just like Vivaldi and Mozart. When you hear them, it just sounds like this coming right out of their head, like they're jamming. And one night when I was copying a piece of music, Jack said, come on over, man. I said, well, I can't. I have to finish this copying. He said, well, I'll tell you some stories while you're copying. For 7 hours, he told me the most incredible story of going to Morocco and then visiting a group of French soldiers and how the Algerian soldiers would come into the barracks of people that were supposed to be their enemy and hang out all night talking as young guys. Finally, I saw that the sun was coming up and I'd finished copying this piece of music. I said, Jack, if I'd only had a tape recorder, that could have been a novel. And he said, that's what I try to do, Davey. I try to make the listener feel that I'm talking to them. And in this case, the listener is also the reader. So I try to have the person who's reading that book feel that I'm speaking to him. And then he said, I can never quite get it. So he was striving for that naturalness to make the formal feel spontaneous.
So I guess there we have encapsulated, David, slightly the problem of trying to make any work of fiction, even to get down on paper and to play the notes of whatever is rattling around inside your head sometimes. I guess it's the ancient curse from Homer to Jack Kerouac and yourself of trying to get the ethereal and the inside of your head on the outside.
And to tell your story, when I used to play with the great jazz, when I played with Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk and these giants I was blessed to be able to be with, and I'd be struggling away as a young kid on my French horn playing a solo, they would say, tell your story, tell your story. And that's what I think all true, sincere music making is about. And I think that's what literature and painting and everything is about, that personal, heartfelt, sincere, beautiful, natural way. And not having the person who's listening or looking realize all the work and effort that you might have put into it. You're trying to give them a gift.
Well, David, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Well, I don't know how better way to leave it than with that word. And we're going to play us out of our chat. We're going to hear you at the British Library last night. So, David, for the meantime, thank you so much for joining us on Midori House.
I thank you. And for all your listeners in London, the area, thank you, everyone, for your graciousness, for your courage, for your high appreciation of the beautiful things of life. And many of us who live across the pond really, really appreciate it.
And that was me speaking to David Amran, a mate of Jack Kerouac's, a bit earlier. And what a great interviewee he was. And on the line now, we have beat scholar and editor of On the Road, the original scroll, Howard Cannell. Thank you for joining us on Midori House, Howard.
No, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me. David, wonderful.
I guess it's been a great few days having the scroll at the British Library. It was a book you wrote. It must be amazing. It must be nice to see the look on other people's faces seeing it for the first time.
Well, you know, I think it's a fantastic opportunity for people to have a look at what is, you know, one of the most significant and celebrated artifacts in contemporary American literary history, you know. It's only the second time it's been in the UK. It came over to Birmingham a couple of years ago, thanks to Richard Ellis. But, you know, this is the key document in the history of one of the most popular novels of the last 50 years, so it's wonderful to see it.
And it's got that amazing, I mean, for Kerouac to tape 100 pages of this typewriter paper together so that it was one unbroken thing is sort of a work of art in itself, isn't it? It's sort of like a Bayeux tapestry or something.
I think the thing to think about there is that this is something he made. He consciously made the scroll as opposed to discovering it, and that gives you an indication that what the scroll was the solution to a problem, and the problem was that he'd been working on the road for 2.5 years prior to writing the scroll in April 1951, and he was unable to finish the novel. And one way to finish the novel was to not stop, you know, so to create something where he could carry on, you know, and go fast, as he said, yeah. Because the road is fast.
And it's got, and it does, I guess it's one of those things, it's the thing that entirely encapsulates the words that are on the page. There are spelling mistakes, there are typos, there are things that didn't make it into the original, the final edited version, the Penguin paperback, if you will. I guess this is something that really bears out the words that are on the page.
It does do that, I think. And I think, what you'd like to have people get from this when they come and see this wonderful artifact is a sense of Kerouac's artistic daring and strength of character in creating the scroll. And if that gets people to go back and look at his other novels, in particular, I'd say Visions of Cody, which is Kerouac's great masterpiece, and unfortunately not as widely known as it should be, then that would be a wonderful thing.
And it's one of those things, isn't it? It's great to be able to sit at the British Library. Is it a rare thing, I suppose, to be able to be, or for people to be excited about seeing the original draft of something that at the end of the day, is a book that maybe is as enjoyable to read on the bus as it is to sort of check out the manuscript itself?
Well, there's a couple of answers there, I think. One of them is that, you know, the thing is extraordinarily to look at, you know, as an artifact, as you said, a work of art. It's a remarkable thing to have constructed, and it's just interesting in its own right. The other thing is, this is the, you know, this is the first complete version of a novel that continues to inspire young people, you know, all over the world to realise their own creative and spiritual potential. So because it's Kerouac, it has that added significance and that added, you know, joyfulness when you go and see it.
All right, Howard. Well, I'm sure, sorry to be so brief. Thank you very much, Howard Cannell, author of On the Road, The Original Scroll. And that's it for today's edition of Midori House. The news is up next, and then Andrew Tuck with The Urbanist. Thank you very much for tuning in.